Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, looking ahead to the second Synod of Bishops on Africa, which opens here in the Vatican on Sunday. We hear from a Nigerian Archbishop and a Superior General, both of whom will be participating in the next 3 weeks of discussions on the Church in Africa in the service of reconciliation, justice and peace. The Archdiocese of Birmingham in the UK gets a new leader. Bishop Bernard Longley talks to us about the challenges ahead. And making a joyful noise unto the Lord. That's exactly what a group of English singers and musicians have been doing here in Rome this week. This Sunday, the second Synod of Bishops on Africa opens here in the Vatican, with over 200 bishops plus religious men and women and lay experts gathering to discuss the Church in Africa in the service of reconciliation, justice and peace. Pope Benedict himself will be presiding at many of the discussions over the next 3 weeks, as the Synod tackles issues ranging from enculturation to ecumenism, dialogue with Islam to economic justice for the continent. Among the Synod Fathers returning for this second major meeting on Africa is Archbishop John Onaiyekin of Abuja in Nigeria, who's been closely involved in the preparatory stages over the past few years.
I was involved for several years in following up what happened after the first African Synod, and we thought we hadn't finished that job, that chapter, when the late Pope John Paul II, quietly, for a lot of people like a surprise, says the second one is coming. But the moment the announcement was made, it became quite logical, especially in the context of the fact that synods have now become a normal way of moving the church forward. And there's no doubt that the church in Africa needs to be moved forward. But above all, the first African synod is like casting a global glance over the whole work of the church in Africa, because the theme was broad, evangelization in Africa towards the year 2000. Now the year 2000 has come and we're already almost a decade into the third millennium. And the second African Synod will zero in more specifically on things we already mentioned in 1994. Obviously, a lot of water has passed under the bridge between 1994 and now. I'm not sure whether things are better or whether we've learned our lessons. But in any case, the African Synod will be a wonderful opportunity to once again compare notes, draw attention of the rest of the world to what is happening in Africa. And I believe it will not only deal with the internal affairs of Africa and how badly we rule ourselves, but also in what international context all this is taking place. Because everybody now agrees that the apparent insoluble questions, problems in many parts of Africa, of wars and so on, are not unconnected with foreign influences. Not that one wants to abdicate the responsibility of our leaders, but if we were not in a globalized world, many of those things would have stopped by now. And so perhaps if we could draw the attention of the rest of the world to what is happening, then the proper interventions, we hope, will take place so that the sources of conflict, the fountains of arms, will be gradually removed, so that people will then have more time to face positive projects in the continent. The fear that some of us are having is that we are not seeing as much enthusiasm about this second African Council Synod as we saw in the first one, which, however, was a novelty at the time.
It's a great moment of reflection, really, to think what has Christianity meant and meant to Africa. What does it mean now? Christianity in Africa is the biggest growth area, if you like, for Christianity in the world, and it will grow even greater over the next 40, 50 years.
Another participant in this second Synod on Africa is Father Kieran O'Reilly, Superior General of the Society of African Missions, which has been dedicated to working on the continent since its foundation in 1856. The Synod is expected to shine the spotlight on many of the complex issues such as education, healthcare, and participation of the laity in the life of the Church that were raised during Pope Benedict's recent visits to Cameroon and Angola back in March of this year. Father Kieran sat down with me to talk about the presence of his own order in some of those African countries and his hopes for the forthcoming Synod.
One of the great problems for many countries in sub-Saharan Africa is either the civil war or the destabilisation through regional conflicts. Even these days we hear again of the disturbing news from the Congo, from the east, the Great Lakes area. So all of these are kind of worrying situations, and there are a number of other countries in Africa where at this moment, like Somalia, in the whole area of Darfur, where there are serious disturbances, civil and military disturbances, that are causing great pain and suffering, especially for women and children. Other countries along West Africa, like Liberia and Sierra Leone, have emerged from their civil wars, from their regional wars, and are thankfully beginning to rebuild. But it's a terrible cost on the people, on society, on the whole culture of life and fabric of life in these countries. So we can only hope and pray that more of the African countries will emerge from this and be able to build true countries of justice and peace.
The upcoming Synod on Africa will reflect on the Church's mission in promoting reconciliation, justice and peace. Would you say that this is perhaps the most important area of the Church's mission today?
It is. I mean, in proclaiming the gospel, in proclaiming who Jesus Christ is, then ultimately we are proclaiming the whole issue of a relationship. And relationship is ultimately following on his relationship with the Father through the Spirit, is our relationship with one another as human beings living on the same earth in the same part of the world, let us say Africa. They are brothers and sisters committed to peace and justice and harmony. Now, for me, that is the message, the core message of what Jesus Christ has brought. So the leaders of our church in Africa are the ones then who are charged with the task of seeing how that can be integrated fully into the life and into the way of being in Africa. And it's a tremendous challenge because Africa has grown enormously, population-wise, in the last 20 years. Some countries have doubled their population and are liable to continue to increase enormously. So there are great human challenges. And yet if there isn't an attempt to build a culture of peace and stability and development, we're really facing quite difficult situations in many countries. And I think the Church has a very important role because, as I said, we in a country like Angola celebrating 500 years of presence, in many other countries the Church has been present for 150, nearly 200 years, right along West Africa, like our own society, the African Missions. So our presence there has been significant. The bishops themselves are now almost all indigenous bishops. So they are the ones charged with the task in their own countries of speaking to their own brothers and sisters in their own languages, in their own cultures, about the reality of communicating the message of the gospel. The heart of the gospel being to establish the right relationships among ourselves so that in so doing we create those right relationships with our God and with the world, the created world in which we live in.
Many of the church leaders, priests, missionaries, lay people have been very powerful witnesses, haven't they? Many of them even giving their lives in this effort.
It is a fact that throughout Africa, in different parts, many have been courageous, even as you say, to the extent that they have given their lives. Many bishops have been willing to risk their lives, to risk everything in order to speak up for the poorest in their society. They have courageously taken on leaders who could threaten them, and yet they never cowed, they never feared or ran away. So it's a great testimony to the courage of many of our bishops, some of whom have paid with their lives, or priests, sisters, lay members, who courageously stayed with people, especially during times of war or marauding armies or travelling around like that. And so they have been, as in a case like, if I may give an example, like Liberia, where Archbishop Michael Francis was a real beacon of hope for the church and for the entire Liberian nation. He spoke out courageously, irrespective of who was in power, against injustice, against discrimination, against ethnic hatred. He really tried and showed what it was to witness to the gospel.
You have your own SMA fathers down in Angola, don't you? Tell us a little bit about their work there today.
Well, we are recently there, in fact. We have only gone to Angola in the last 10 years. It is a presence of our Italian province that is down there, and we have one member also from a French province. And they are largely in the urban ministry in Luanda. And they are, like in other parts of Africa, the urban ministry is perhaps the most demanding, because the mass migration into the great urban centres is a phenomenon that is witnessed in all parts of the two-thirds world, but especially in Africa, where, as you know, a large number of young people especially migrate into the city in the hope of a better life, in the hope of education, work. And one of the great challenges that I have seen travelling in these big cities like Lagos or Kinshasa or along the west coast is the amount of young people, some of them well qualified, some of them from primary or secondary schools, maybe in university, but without any work and no real hope of it, that there is a kind of an imbalance in the economic development that has very serious consequences. And really, ministering in the great urban areas is following through very much on the encyclical of Pope John Paul II on Redemptoris Missio. These are the great areas of evangelization now, and it is an enormous challenge for the church, for missionaries, men and women, to try and address the huge social problems that are emerging in places where 20 years ago there was no cities, and they're there now. You know?
So you're dealing with issues above all like healthcare, with the AIDS pandemic, perhaps one of the most serious challenges, I imagine.
As always, the church has been to the fore in major areas of health and education. And as you rightly say, one of the areas that has come to the fore in the last 10 to 15 years is the whole area of the AIDS and the consequences, the social consequences, how the fabric of society gets torn asunder, how when the parents die, the grandparents are sometimes left with children that they can hardly be able to manage, to feed, how youngsters are in fact the senior in a family of 14, 15 years of age may have to take care of his cousins. So the church is at the forefront of these different challenges to the social fabric, because it's very serious, really. If you have no one to pass on the culture, if you have no one to pass on the fabric or how to make the fabric of a culture, you're really sowing the seeds for social disintegration. And it's a real frightening prospect that if you're in the great urban areas, you have mass amount of youngsters who are really not being, if you like, brought into a wider, broader, positive cultural way of doing things, you're creating a very dangerous system into the future of breakdown and disintegration. And for me, one of the main challenges for the church remains in that pastoral frontier, if you like, of trying to cope with that reality of the collapse of culture.
It's an incredibly difficult situation. We tend to hear so much about the problems, and yet Africa remains the continent of hope, doesn't it? How do you keep this hope alive faced with these incredibly difficult problems?
Well, the hope stays alive, really, because of the African people themselves. I mean, they are wonderful. In the face of enormous odds, when things are going against them, they have courage, they have capacity to be tenacious, they keep going, they always see hope for their children, for their grandchildren. Despair is something that I have found very little in Africa. There is always a sense of joy and a thanks to God for the little they have even. I suppose we come from a different kind of world where we want so much more, we're never satisfied. But there you see the human spirit accomplish great things with very little and achieve wonderful things for the sake of others, for their family, for their friends. It really is hope-filled, even though you would think there's no reason to have hope. But the people are the reason that why we have hope ourselves.
And my thanks there to Father Kieran O'Reilly, Superior General of the Society of African Missions. Another Irish priest who has worked for many years in Africa is Jesuit Father Jerry Whelan. Formerly a parish priest in Nairobi, Kenya, Father Jerry now teaches pastoral and fundamental theology at Rome's Gregorian University. His experiences with small Christian communities in Africa helped to focus his work on ecumenical cooperation and spiritual formation, two issues he hopes will be at the heart of this three-week synod.
The theme of the synod is really social justice reconciliation. So it's very related to Catholic social teaching, to the mission of the church in the history of Africa, so to speak. I have this great concern that We know how to integrate our spiritual mission with our mission of action in the world. From my experience in Africa, there can be a tendency to split the two. And for example, as a parish priest worrying about money all the time, you can get money for social work. You never get money for spiritual formation work. And yet, things go very wrong if you don't have a community that's growing in holiness and personal morality flowing out into this social morality. So my first concern for the synod is that we do our job as Christians, really, which is integrate faith with justice and be very clear that that is a challenge in the formation of our Christian communities. Then, as I said, if we're doing that, ecumenism will be obvious. First and foremost, ecumenism. Then an inter-religious solidarity comes. But more at home is the question of our spiritual union with the fellow Christians from whom we are unfortunately divided.
How easy do you think it's going to be? I mean, the Synod will be looking at the countries right across the continent, from sub-Saharan Africa to the countries of North Africa. Is it possible, do you think, in this kind of gathering, to really be able to focus on some of the issues that affect everybody, although they may have such a different outworking?
Well, very difficult, of course. Just one thing, though, somebody who has been involved with synods speaks about the wonderful dynamic that gets going amongst the bishops themselves in a synod like this. So in one sense, they won't come up with great solutions for justice and reconciliation across all parts of Africa. But there can be something very special that happens as they form themselves into a united body to a greater extent by, you know, meeting each other for the first time sometimes and listening and praying together. And that can bear fruits in ways that might be unpredictable, but can be very, very important.
And my thanks there to Jesuit Father Jerry Whelan, formerly parish priest in Nairobi, Kenya, and now a professor at Rome's Gregorian University. The Archdiocese of Birmingham in the United Kingdom has a new leader. He's Bishop Bernard Longley, currently auxiliary in the Diocese of Westminster. On Thursday, the Vatican announced he will be installed as Archbishop of Birmingham on December the 8th, taking over from Archbishop Vincent Nichols. With the beatification of Cardinal John Henry Newman, plus a papal visit to Britain expected next autumn, Bishop Longley is likely to have a pretty packed agenda over the coming months. I caught up with him just after the announcement on Thursday to find out how he feels about taking such a big step from London up to the Archdiocese of Birmingham.
Well, I think you're right. It is a big change for me, and I'm grateful for having had the experience of moving into the Diocese of Westminster, which, when I arrived there 7 years ago, I didn't really know very well, but getting to learn the challenges and the opportunities there as part of a team with, at that time, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor and over more recently with Archbishop Vincent. And there are similarities, particularly with the eastern and central part of London where I'd been living and working. And from what I've learned so far to date from the bishops and the Archbishop's Council here in Birmingham, particularly I think about the great, very rich social mix within the local communities and also within the Catholic communities, with Catholics from all parts of the world who are part of our Catholic communities here. I think that there's a powerful message there that this unity which is experienced within the Catholic Church is not just a gift for ourselves, but actually a gift for others. So that's certainly something which has struck me very powerfully, even in these recent days.
One of the big issues on the agenda up there around the Birmingham area is, of course, dialogue with the Muslim communities in Britain. You've had some experience of that, haven't you? But are you expecting it to be a major area, a major focus of your work?
I think it will be, and I'm looking forward to working, obviously ecumenically, with the other church leaders, but also as part of the interreligious dialogue, which has really taken root here over the last many years, and which Archbishop Vincent encouraged and was a central part of. And I think the opportunity to work together and witness together in that way is going to remain vital, to be of service beyond the faith communities also, and but to be seen to be available to meet the needs of others and to take our part in public life very properly here.
My thanks there to Bishop Bernard Longley, currently auxiliary in the Diocese of Westminster, but from December the 8th, the new Archbishop of Birmingham. Make a joyful noise unto the Lord. That's exactly what a group of English musicians and singers have been doing in Rome this week, performing a series of reflections in words and music in two churches located at one of the Eternal City's busiest tourist sites, the Pantheon, also known as the Church of St. Mary of the Martyrs, and the nearby Basilica of Santa Maria Sopra Minerva. The new English orchestra and choir is made up of both professional musicians and others from all walks of life looking for a way to share the joys of their Christian faith through their performances. With a huge repertoire ranging from classical to jazz, gospel and folk songs from countries around the world, the group received standing ovations for their performances throughout the day from thousands of pilgrims, music lovers and just ordinary tourists who happened to be visiting and were able to stop for a moment of musical and maybe spiritual reflection. Halfway through their Rome tour, I caught up with the man who founded the New English Orchestra over 30 years ago and who is still the conductor, pianist and driving force behind this ecumenical group.
My name's Nigel Swinford, and I'm the conductor and the founder of the New English Orchestra. It's an orchestra that's dedicated to playing spiritual music, not exclusively religious music, sometimes the classics and folk music, but it looks at the repertoire and the culture from a Christian standpoint.
Tell us a bit about the people who come to play or sing in this orchestra and choir. It's a very eclectic group, isn't it?
It's a very eclectic group, yes, and you have people like Christopher Poffley, the cellist, who plays with John Elliott Gardner and all the top specialist Baroque groups, tours the world with them, and young violinists like Hannah Smith, who's a working professional and is making her way very successfully in England in that way. On the other hand, the singers are populated by medical people, people who are in the area of defence, people who are in town planning, people who teach for a living. All sorts of professions are represented, but they have a musical talent and they want to use it, and particularly they want to use it to glorify God.
What is it that really is the driving inspiration behind this orchestra? You've been going for more than 30 years now, haven't you? As you say, people wanting to use their talents in a very special way.
Yes, that's a difficult question to answer, really. At the most basic level, it's to glorify God, to give him thanks for his creation, to give him thanks for great music, to give him thanks for his son, and for the gospel. And our great desire, I think, is to express it with integrity, not trying to paper over any cracks, not trying to say that everything's easy if you become a Christian, but recognizing the power of God and the love of God as it's spread abroad in a person's life and in the life of a community. It's to say all those things and to give people perhaps who've never thought about it before an eye-opener into what it's like to be a Christian.
you're a very mixed group, not only in the different professions and backgrounds represented, but also ecumenically. You come from a variety of churches, don't you?
We do. I never actually ask anybody of what persuasion they are when they come in. I don't think they'd cope very long here if they weren't believing in Jesus. They wouldn't like the repertoire, for starters. But I don't actually inquire whether they're Protestant or Catholic or what variety of either they might be. But we are a genuinely ecumenical group. We're quite a large group. There are scores of people on the instrumental list and many people on the singers list, and we don't often operate all together. We operate in smaller groups, and you never know when you get a group where the weighting is, whether it's more towards one persuasion or to another. But our joy really is to say that the Lord knows all who are his, and that those who reach out in faith to Christ are in one body.
You're playing in the Pantheon this year and Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, two perhaps of Rome's most significant basilicas. What's it like as an experience for you to play in a place like that?
That was very fascinating. Of course, we had to handle the acoustic of the Pantheon. That was very, very unpredictable. I resisted the idea of going there for quite a while. I thought it was musical suicide. But actually, we've had a lovely time, and we've learned a great deal about how to perform in it. We've learned where to stand to get the best effect. And the joy, of course, is that the audience is there already. There's often 1,000 people, at the very least, in the Pantheon. All you have to do is to start playing and singing, and there is your audience. So it was very exciting for us, actually.
You don't call your performances concerts, you call them recreatio. What do you mean exactly? What do you understand by this?
Well, a recreatio in our minds is a kind of service. One of the clergy at the Pantheon actually called it a paraliturgy. At root, it's simply a sequence of music and readings from the Bible. There are no introductions. It just runs through like a service. But also it commends itself. It's a sort of concert as well, because even if you're not a believer, you can sit there in the audience. You can be refreshed. You can enjoy it. You don't have to stand up or sit down. You don't even have to contribute money in the collection. But you can just hear the word of God and decide what to do with it.
And my thanks there to pianist, composer and conductor Nigel Swinford, the founder of the New English Orchestra that's been performing in Rome this week. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.